This is James McElhinney. Ronnie Lanfield has been a presence on the New York art scene since his work was first exhibited in the Whitney Biennial, 1967. His latest exhibition opens at Findlay Galleries on May 4th and runs through June 3rd. The other day, Ronnie and I met at the gallery to discuss his work and his latest exhibition. Ronnie, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you too. It's been a while.
So it's exciting to see your new work.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear more about what you've been doing in the studio. I guess, you know, the fruits of your labors are on the wall.
Strangely enough, yes. I've noticed that maybe it's the real climate, but I've been making a lot of dark paintings. I guess to make it short and sweet, a lot of dark paintings. A lot of paintings where you look to the future and it's really hard to tell where we're going. And I'm excited in a sense because I'm in a big new studio and I usually trust my art-making being to kind of lead me. And so what's been happening lately almost reminds me of what I did when I was on the Bowery back in the 60s. I mean, I'm painting in, and certainly on Desprosses Street. I'm making stains and putting the paint down in ways that remind me of the way I was doing it maybe 20 years ago in a new way, in a different way, with different results. And there have been a few new paintings that are just, they seem like they're looking to the future. And they're very dark.
You're comparing your new work to the work that you did years ago. Do you see comparisons between the times we're living in now and the times we were living in then?
No.
Is there some narrative driving this?
It's possible. I remember when I returned to making stain painting, which was in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. There was, in a sense, an equivalent feeling that I had. I wanted to tell the truth. I wanted to find a very simple visual language that would actually express everything that I was feeling in a natural way, in a way that could move forward almost daily. And so I returned to making stain paintings. I hadn't for most of the 70s. I was doing all those different things. And it just seemed normal and natural to be able to speak again in that voice, which is what's happened in the last 2 years now up in New Windsor.
Well, the move to New Windsor followed a catastrophic experience with Hurricane Sandy, where your studio was virtually destroyed. And a lot of your work was damaged.
Right.
And the place you had inhabited for many years was uninhabitable.
4 decades.
I'm curious to know how you think your move to the country, or at least out of the city, to the northern edge of the Hudson Highlands, has influenced.
That's actually a good question that I almost can't answer yet, although I can say that being there has been a cliche, breath of fresh air. It's been relaxing. It's been renewing. I mean, to hear quiet, to be in the quiet, to be in isolation, to be surrounded by a kind of natural environment with inherent dangers, as nature mm-hmm. always provides, mm-hmm. it's a blessing. It makes me grateful and wistful about the complexity of Lower Manhattan, which is a place where I live for 60 years. But at the same time, I like the quiet. I like the beauty. I like being there. But the irony for me is, if we look at my paintings, especially those paintings that I painted in the 80s, 90s, and most of the last 20 years, living in the city, they're very landscape-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
My work is still very landscape-oriented. I think simply because it's nature. It's who we all are. We are, as Pollock said, I'm nature. We are. He's right. It's us. We have the ground underneath us. We have the sky above us.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that happens in our lives is in between. And that's where art comes from. As far as I can tell, when I go into the depths of my being, that's what I got. That's all I got. That's all I got. It's who I am, what I experience, and I'm trying to express that. So to be in the country, to be in the quiet, is a blessing.
Well, people talk about the urban landscape, and they talk about the pastoral landscape, and they talk about the wild landscape. But what you're saying, and I agree, is the landscape is a projection. It's what people see whenever they turn their attention outward to the environment in which they live. It's intriguing.
I think what we do is the landscape of the mind.
Yes.
And in terms of the wild landscape, I painted paintings in the mountains of Utah. I painted paintings in the pastoral, which is where I am
right
these days. And I painted paintings in the city, in the urban landscape, et cetera, et cetera. And it's the landscape of the mind.
Right.
It's really how you feel, what's going on, what are we confronting, what have we learned, what do we want to say. And we can do it anywhere.
In a previous conversation that we had in another gallery, you spoke about feeling a connection with the Hudson River School in a way, the sort of American
right
landscape
right
tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd be curious to have you unpack that for me.
Well, I don't know if I can, but I've been feeling connected to the Hudson River School since 1968. And historically, if I can go back in time, I mean, again, it's my own spin, but I remember being, you know, a young guy. I was 21 years old, living on a Bowery, and one, you know, I had just had a painting at the Whitney Annual, and I was, you know, wanting to be hip like my friends and be part of the art world and stuff, and I was learning stuff about what was hip, slick, and cool, and what was hip, slick, and cool was, oh no, you can't paint. That's done. That's over. Painting is illusionistic. Painting is a lie. Painting is like not cool. No way. I'm Donald Judd, man. I know everything. I'm Mr. Better follow me. I'm going to make an object. And the emptiness, the absolute emptiness that Donald Judd had the gall to hold up in front of me, I had already experienced in San Francisco when I was 17. So I had been there already. I had been to the absolute. I made all these paintings about the void. And one day I had finished 15 paintings, 9 feet high, 6 feet wide, all about the void, the absolute, Donald Judd in his empty space. And Dan Christensen said, okay, Ronnie, what do you do now? Thank you, Dan. And what I realized was what I'm going to do now is I'm going to fill the void with my life. I'm going to express who I am and what I am. I don't give a damn what Donald Judd and his hip, slick, and cool friends have to say about what's hip, slick, and cool. 21 years old. So I made a painting, and I called it Heaven and Earth. And it was 9 feet high, 11 feet wide. It had a yellow hard-edge border, and the center was painted with rollers and some copper paint, and it was essentially an abstract landscape. And I realized the way it felt was directly connected, certainly not to French painting. It was much more crude than that. It was directly connected to the Hudson River School. And I understood that. I showed it to Klaus Curtis, and I got to show it at the Bikert Gallery, central home base for minimalism. It was a perfect place. And I showed Heaven and Earth, and it changed my life. The painting I did after that was called Sheet River, which Philip Johnson wound up acquiring, and it's in the collection of Stanford University. And it was deep space, painted for Donald Jung. It was my most illusionistic painting. I put lines on the picture plane to show deep space, telling a lie, because painting is painting. There's nothing wrong with painting, man. It's a language. It's cool. It's okay. As far as I'm concerned, it's okay. Still doing it. So my connection to the Hudson River School goes back to what I began to understand about those American painters like Thomas Cole, mm-hmm. who were here. And they were seeing the Church and Bierstadt. They were seeing this vast, unknown place. And they were able to make these mysterious and compelling images in the city.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people don't realize, is that these guys were not painting up in the woods.
Right.
Of course,
some of them did.
When they got money enough, they were able to
take a trip and
build houses up there too. Yeah,
but in the city, they're painting these. Not to say there's anything wrong with Monet and with the Impressionists, Post-Impressionists, but there's nothing wrong with Hudson River School. And I became a big fan of American painting at that point.
It's interesting, you know, the Dan Flavin Foundation has a very important collection of Hudson River School sketchbooks.
I'm not surprised.
And
good for them.
He was very fond of these drawings.
And why wouldn't he be? Yeah. Sure.
And
good stuff.
But it is kind of a backbeat in American art. And certainly here in New York, like you said, these painters were living and painting in New York. They were going up the river to get inspired. And
coming back and working in the studio.
Exactly.
Not a big difference, yes. And with Judd, you know, Marfa, he still has a huge impact, died too young. I liked Donald. It wasn't like I didn't like the guy, but I didn't buy into anything he had to say. Certainly not about space, and certainly not about the absolute, and certainly not about painting.
Well, we could talk endlessly about Marfa and about other artists like Rex Drawdowns and others who have gone out of the city like everyone has, and in order to get inspired to come back to work.
And again, you know, I think about Monet. I mean, I've come to that. Giverny, you live out there. You kind of spend time with yourself, with your family, with your dealer. And, you know, you do your thing. I mean, at a certain point, that's what we got. We got ourselves. And then there's our interrelationships, certainly. And, you know, at a certain point, I've been in this art world here in New York City for my entire life. I went to high school in it. Tom Wesselman, you know, we used to talk when I was in high school. He was one of the teachers. Dick Bellamy, you know, I worked for Dick when I was 17 years old. I thought I was 16, but I think I actually turned 17. You know, it was crazy.
Well, that must have been a terrific formative experience, too, to be exposed to all of these artists.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember going to the Green Gallery, you know. And, again, you know, it was so many years ago, our memories kind of collide and mix and get flat, etc., blah, blah, I can't remember this, can't remember that. I remember going to Green Gallery quite vividly, and Janice Gallery, Cindy Janice. And then I went to Coots Gallery and ran into Hans Hoffman. So here I am, like a high school kid, right? And I go into this art gallery to see this show. It's a Hoffman show. And there's Hoffman. I'm 16 years old. I was 16. We start talking. So to me, this was natural. This was just what was going on, what was, you know, what you could expect.
Let's talk a little about the work that's on the wall here at David Findlay Galleries.
The Findlay Gallery currently has paintings of mine. I call them recent, but in 1995, I kind of returned to this manner of painting and have been working out of this since. So it's actually, it's not that recent, 95 to now, it's like 20 years.
Well, that's 20 years, yeah.
And so there's a kind of nice mix of pictures that I think the oldest maybe is like 98, 97, mm-hmm. and some of the more recent ones are 2012.
So it's an overview of
that whole period,
that body of work that this began painting. With a return to
yes, and now
staining.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a return to staining; it was a return to a particular type of staining with brush, with these big shapes, with a lot of drawing, and now I'm beginning to combine as I did in the Stux Haller show. Those paintings in 2015, mm-hmm. I began to use the brush and stain again in a kind of wide open way, which I'm doing less with the brush these days in the studio.
Are you pouring more?
Yeah, exactly. So, using squeegees, I'm pouring more.
Interesting to look at your process too, because you have this large platform that's slightly inclined,
right.
That lets the gravity.
Right.
Do predictable things to the wet paint as it enters the canvas.
Right. So, which gives me a certain degree of control.
Right.
And which is important, so that it's not just utter random. It's actually attempting to express various unexpressible images and feelings with some sort of clarity, or that's the point. But every time I look up, I realize that this guy does it better than I can ever do it. I've been amazed at what goes on up there my whole life. Yeah.
So it's a different sky up in the northern highlands.
No, yeah. There's actually more than one star.
Yes. And it's not a street light.
Yeah, that's true too.
So there's less ambient light from the city.
Yeah.
So you can see more of the celestial activity.
Yeah, and it's nice clarity actually. It's very visual.
But you know, you're in an area that's rich with history. I mean, you're in an area that was the final encampment of the Continental Army. It's next door to Storm King Art Center. It's where the poet and the critic N.P. Willis, who named Storm King, lived, and it's not far from West Point.
Oh, and Storm King Islands. Mountain, too.
Yeah,
drive
right,
over
that
mountain.
Yeah. Beautiful. Storm King used to be called Butter Hill, which is kind of not so... It looked like a butter loaf to the Dutch.
Uh-huh.
But then N.P. Willis said, no, this isn't a mound of butter. This is a Storm King.
Actually, he was right, because that's where all the storm hits.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And the Hudson River School. I mean, this is, you know, my friend Betty lives in Catskill. Mm-hmm. And this is the universe. This is where it is. I love New York State. And even as a young art student, I always felt that New York State kind of like is where all the post-impressionists and the impressionists did their outdoor painting. It's just like France. It's you got everything here. I love the state of New York.
Well, it's also the Highlands is like the American Rhineland. Mm-hmm. And it's a very picturesque quality.
I can dig that. Yeah.
So I'm curious to know about your most recent work.
Well, as I say, very dark.
Very dark.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to draw parallels because I'm immediately reminded of a painting by Martin Johnson Heade that was painted in 1863 at the height of the Civil War that has this black sky.
I'm not using black. I'll show you an image. But what I'm doing, I'm making a lot of big paintings, 26-foot paintings. I haven't cut yet. I usually, what I do is I'll work very large, 20, 25 feet, 24 feet.
How large is that platform of yours?
It's 26 feet.
That's big.
So it's 12 by 26. And I'll do a big picture and usually crop. Lately, I haven't been stretching anything. So, you know, like this new.
So we're looking at a painting with a very dark upper half, which could be interpreted as sky, and and also a darker, like lower half, which could be interpreted as terrain.
Right.
So it's very evocative of landscape. As a younger artist,
I was going to call it View to the Future.
You must have been very aware of people like Kandinsky and Mondrian and their links back to landscape.
Well, I was indeed, and frankly, with Mondrian, I never liked his flowers and/or landscape paintings until the show at the Modern, and that kind of opened my eyes. So, in other words, when I was a kid, I was aware of that move, how a lot of these, a lot of that generation of mystical abstractionists. Made the move away from imagery, but I didn't really understand the quality of what they were giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see some of Mondrian's imagery paintings, they're very good. They're really good.
Yeah, wonderful.
And, yeah.
But the other thing, too, is...
But he took a stand. And
he didn't just pop up and have a theory and start working out of that. It was like a gradual evolution.
Mm-hmm.
He evolved out of from color to black and white, and then from imagery to measuring space and crosses in space, and then ultimately...
I hear you. I mean, in terms of my life and my evolution, my development, well, I would go to the Sidney Janis Gallery a lot. Mm-hmm. Again, as I would go to the Green Gallery, my favorite place to go was Sidney Janis, because I wanted to see Motherwell and I wanted to see Gottlieb and I wanted to see de Kooning and I wanted to see Klein, and I wanted, I think he still had Pollock, I don't remember. I wanted abstract expressionism, that's where I wanted to be, and he showed Mondrian also. And I will never forget seeing at the Alan Stone Gallery a major Willem de Kooning show and a Barnett Newman show together. There was Alan Stone Gallery had de Kooning and Newman. And I couldn't get Newman for the life of me. I didn't understand. And it just seemed like, why? I mean, what is this man doing? And that really changed my entire understanding of abstraction and painting.
Mm-hmm.
Contemplating Newman and understanding his color, understanding the surface tension between the large open field and the zips and the stripes. And understanding their connection to Mondrian.
So what helped you come to terms with one-ment?
Learning how to see. Learning to understand back and forth. I mean, Hoffman talks about it. Learning to understand the surface tension that's in Diebenkorn, heavily in Barney Newman. And that's what Mondrian gave us. He gave us, when we look hard, he gave us his understanding of surface tension. It's got very little to do with how thick the paint is.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to do with placement. It's got to do with perfection.
Well, and if you look at Mondrian's paintings, they're not tidy at all. There's revisions, pentimenti, pieces of tape still in the paint. He's constantly revising and moving them and changing
and
them.
Enormously expressive and alive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially those late paintings.
You told me a story once about how you had a meeting with Clement Greenberg, and he was having a look at a painting of yours that had a bar of color with a hard edge against a stained field of color, and told you that you couldn't do both at once.
Right.
That's a great story. Would you share that again?
Well, I don't exactly remember what I said back then, because, again, I'm getting old. But Clem essentially said to me, you know, the paintings aren't unified. They have to be one way or the other. My paintings were, especially then, were a kind of hard against soft. I was doing these bands against the stain, geometry with the landscape. I saw it sometimes as foreground, middle ground, background. At the time, I thought of the song Hey Jude, in which the Beatles start out with this song text, and it's Hey Jude, da, 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 and it ends up with this na 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 na, right, like two songs.
Right.
And it was kind of like, hey, it wasn't hard to understand. And I just basically understood Clem as being incapable of understanding my paintings. And that was okay. You know, he was a different generation. And that was actually, for me, it was elucidating. And I began to understand that I had to pay attention really tightly and closely to myself and not to other people and their input and what they understood things to be. Now, not to say there's anything wrong with unification, not to say there's anything wrong with, because I do what I want now. And if I want to paint a painting with a band, I do. And if I don't, I don't. And it's a matter of the language and having something to say and saying it because you mean it. And my understanding of this person telling me that this is the right way to do it and that's the wrong way to do it struck me as someone who basically didn't really understand that there's something new and he had to make an adjustment as opposed to setting up a priori. And if that were the case, we wouldn't have Kandinsky, we wouldn't have Mondrian, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have anything that would move forward.
None of those artists would have taken the chances that they had taken or tried to propose the work that they did, right? They wouldn't have done it because it wouldn't have...
It wouldn't be right. And therefore,
it would have been wrong.
It didn't fit in the catacomb, in the category. And, you know, you're not supposed to do it that way. You're supposed to do it this way. Great, Clem. And anybody at that point, at that moment in time, it was a moment when the art world was exploding in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, which side are you on?
There were a lot of polemics about representation versus abstraction, painterly abstraction versus geometric abstraction, object versus non-object. All of that's kind of in the wind now, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I remember having a conversation with Arthur Danto. Again, I'm losing track of time. It was 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
Arthur had written Anything Goes. But it was quite clear that anything goes except for abstract painting. Because there was all this kind of antipathy to Greenberg. And I remember I had Arthur in my studio. And I said, now, when you say anything goes, does that mean anything except these paintings? We wound up having some very interesting conversation about that.
So when someone comes to see this exhibition, what are you hoping they're going to take away?
I hope they see themselves in the paintings. I hope they can actually feel as human beings, what another human being perceived in the world of their lifetimes. That's A. I think that's the gift. And if somebody can receive that gift, I'd be very happy. And I hope that that's what happens. I want people to be able to relate to the work in ways that they can relate their lives and their experience to what they see. Even though it's not a picture of a place, it's not a picture of a person, it's not a picture of anything or any place that they've actually been. But it's a place and picture of everywhere they've been. And it's a little awkward, but...
It's much in the spirit of people like Frederick Church, who made a big point of saying when he exhibited his works, this is not a picture of a real place, it's a composite.
Well, again, I do admire the Hudson River School, but I relate more strongly to the abstract expression.
Of course, that's...
And, you know, it's a kind of marriage mm-hmm. of emotion and insight and vision, all combined into something that nobody's ever seen before. Well, and that's the goal. The person who influenced me the most as a painter would be Pollock.
Well, one could say that the two major canonical movements or the two manifestations of American art that have had the greatest impact over the course of the history of the Republic been the Hudson River School and abstract expression.
I would agree with you. And
so you see your work as being a fusion of those
two. I do, yeah. That's a good way to put it. That's actually a very good way to put it.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's correct.
Yeah. I think that I'm coming from that American place that in 68, again, when I really began to think about creating me as an artist, getting away from... but I wanted to create a bridge between abstract expressionism and the way I perceived this kind of new minimalism or hard edge or clear objective expressionism. And I was searching for a bridge, and I think the landscape made a lot of sense. And then the notion of there was something wrong with the American painting. There was nothing wrong with American painting. Nothing. And the American Hudson River School was very interesting.
When you say there's nothing wrong with American painting, you mean the traditional prejudice in favor of European painting?
Precisely.
Right.
Precisely. Precisely. I mean, Whistler is kind of a funny character. Mm-hmm. So sort of falls in the middle there. So
yeah, he treads
American guy in Europe.
He's in the interstices of America.
Somewhere Europe, in the middle.
Right?
Yeah.
You're a teacher, and you are in contact with students all the time. You're teaching at the Art Students League. You've taught elsewhere, SVA and Bennington and elsewhere. And if one of your students comes into to see this exhibition, as I'm sure all of them will,
I hope.
What are you hoping they'll learn from it?
I want them to understand that it's a language, that what they're doing is dialoguing with themselves when they paint. And I want them to understand themselves. I want them to be able to take whatever they can gather or gain from seeing what I do and translate that into what they do. That's my hope for my students. I want them to be able to do the dialogue that needs to be done within their inner self and their ability to make a created work of art.
So now that you see all the work on the wall, or almost on the wall, it's out there being placed as we speak, a lot of discussion and pictures moving around. What revelations have you experienced having looked at the work in this new space?
It's always a puzzle to me at this point. You know, seeing, I remember that, I remember that, I remember where I was then. It's a somewhat of an incomplete take on being, and yet it's hard to put into words. I mean, right now, I'm very gratified to see the paintings, and it's been a long haul. I mean, the last 4 years has been pretty crazy. We had a lot to do, and it's been kind of very gratifying that these paintings are being able to be seen again in public. It's hard to say. I mean, how do I feel? I remember being really elucidated by seeing my first show and my second show, but I'm a bit jaded at this point.
After a while, an exhibition is an exhibition, and it's
just appealing.
Like, you know, you grow the grapes, you make the wine, you bottle the wine, you open the bottle.
I don't want to seem that jaded, though. I mean, it's it's always kind of cool. Yeah.
I guess what I was hoping you could share is any surprise that you may have experienced.
Yeah, I hear you. And it's always a surprise. Like, we showed a lot of these paintings or this group of paintings in Florida. And I was down there a few months ago, and I was shocked, actually. It was, wow, is that me? I do that? Yeah. There is that element. And now, when I walked into the gallery just an hour ago, or 2 hours ago, whenever we got here, I had that same kind of hit. And it's always a hit.
I mean, isn't that why we paint? You say, gee, I got a feeling. I wonder what it looks like.
Yeah, I can hear you, man. I mean, because I can't tell. I mean, when I'm in my studio, it's just like running at the Hoffman on the street. You know, it's like, it's all natural. It's people ask me questions, but like, how did you do this? How did you do that? And it's always just doing what came natural, you know.
So you trust your process. You trust your process.
Yeah, I do.
And you're hoping people who come to see the show will trust theirs.
Well, yeah. I hope that people can understand that art doesn't have to hit them over the head. Art doesn't have to pick their pocket. Art doesn't have to shock them into confessing. Art doesn't have to turn them upside down and run for the hills. That actually they're alive. And hopefully this art will remind them that they're alive and that they think and they matter and they feel. And that's okay.
Thanks so much, Ronnie. This has been really great. I wish you all possible success with this show. It's a beautiful show.
I appreciate it.
And it's always great talking to you.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks. The exhibition, Ronnie Landfield, American Color Field Master, will be on view through June 3rd at Findlay Galleries, located on the 7th floor at 724 5th Avenue, between 56th and 57th Streets. Gallery hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and by appointment. To learn more about Ronnie Landfield and his work, please visit his website at www.landfield.com. This is James McElhinney. Thanks for listening.